Hey, Steele.
Dave, it's been a while. I've missed you.
I've been lonely. Yeah, you talked with women the last time you were on the podcast.
Yeah, I felt in my element. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, Steele. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Dave, I'm doing really great. I'm just happy today.
Steele, I want you to know I just ate like 3 gummy worms and I drank a can of Doc Holliday soda. So I'm so ready to record a podcast right now.
Amped. I had a pasta for lunch, so I'm feeling the opposite.
No, you're carb loaded. You should have some endurance.
Yeah, it's true. Well, Dave, I am really glad that you're back on the show.
Yeah, the last show was pretty female. So I think the topics we're going to discuss today lean a lot more towards the nerd Dave interests than possibly the last show leaned towards.
Yeah, so no women. If you're listening to this, you may just want to come back next week because there's nothing for you here.
No, once we get into the naming part, women like names.
Yeah, it's true. I brought something that women will like to the episode, I guess.
Yeah, none of that's coming from me, just you.
Okay. Well, we got a lot to cover. We're going to talk about the NBA draft and some sartorial decisions. We're going to talk about Jurassic World, Jurassic Park. We're going to play another instance of Lost the Plot, which I am very excited for. We're going to talk about some overlooked biblical names. We have an induction into the Off the Chain Hall of Fame. And then, as usual, we have Unchained Melodies and Book Wisdom. And this time, it's 4th of July America themed.
And still, what's more American than talking about the NBA draft and critiquing the clothes that players are wearing to the draft? There's nothing more American than this.
No. Super tall, 18 to 21-year-olds talking about their fashion choices. When they're paid to wear like very tight tank tops for a living is so American.
So I watched part of the recent draft and I got really excited by one thing. Still, can you possibly guess what excited me the most?
Well, if we're talking the world of fashion,
yes, we are.
Would it have been like the 7-foot Latvian guy? That guy has a future.
I love all their fashion choices, but I think most of these fashion choices, when you look back through time, they actually get dated quite quickly. But one thing that never gets dated is a sweet pendant.
Oh, yeah. Jewelry. Jewelry never goes out of style.
No. And my favorite jewelry from this year's draft was a custom-designed pendant for Willie Cauley-Stein.
Ooh.
If you look at it, it's got the WCS on it, diamonds, gold. And it's just fantastic. It's just really well done.
You know, it looked a little bit to me kind of like the style of the New York Knicks logo, the long curving letters. It was quite attractive.
He made an excellent choice. And you're not going to look back at that and think, that was a stupid thing to wear. No, you're going to look back and like, that guy has class. I can see why he made it in the NBA.
It's basically the opposite of his neck tattoos, you're saying.
He's looking for a balance.
Yeah.
You got to find a balance.
Yeah, that was a really impressive moment in the draft this year. Unfortunately, I didn't watch the draft, so I didn't get to see all the fashion up close. But were there any other favorites, Dave? Who won the clothing sweepstakes this time?
There was actually a few that looked like really good. I liked Russell, the second pick in the draft. He had a pretty flamboyant red blazer, and like it looked really good, I thought. I thought he looked really sharp. But my favorite has to be Rondae Hollis Jefferson's pants.
Oh, I saw those. University of Arizona player.
We know about fashion down here. But it's like a red and black stripe. Well, it looks like an old-fashioned hunting shirt, except made into pants.
Yeah, it was like flannel. I think they were flannel. And they have little buttons, probably, so you could take them off if you get too warm. Was he drafted by the Portland Trailblazers? Because they looked very trailblazery to me.
He was. He was drafted by the Trailblazers because they saw the pants. And they're like, flannel pants? I think you're going to fit well in Portland. But unfortunately, he was traded. I don't remember where he got traded to.
Heartbreaker. You know, when I saw those, it reminded me of probably, I think, one of the all-time worst draft outfits. Had the plaid pants, but just disaster all around. A couple years ago, the Timberwolves drafted a guy named Wesley Johnson out of Syracuse, Dave. You got to look this picture up. This is back when David Stern was the commish. But he's got these terrible-looking, like, golf-style plaid pants. He's got, like, an old man, double-breasted, gold-button blazer. And then, like, a gold banker shirt with a white collar. An awful red tie. And then a tie clip he's wearing very high up. It's pretty disastrous. He looks like he belongs to...
Still, you want the tie clip to be seen. You don't want to just have it on there and people not see it, so you got to wear it high. One of the things these guys have to struggle with, it's something that I struggle with. I'm very short, but they're on the opposite side of the spectrum, and they're so tall. Any fashion mistake that they make is just exacerbated by their frame.
Yeah. You can never have too many buttons on some of these guys. They've got like 8-button suit jackets or whatever, and they're like, it looks a little blousy.
But you wanted to talk a little bit about all-time best draft outfits.
Oh, yeah.
What do you got?
So my all-time favorite, I think actually all-time best, was James Harden. And James Harden is legendary for just being an awesome-looking guy with an incredible beard. But
that's
when he was
my favorite player.
Yeah, when he was drafted, he also had style. Like, he looked really good. This is back in 2009, and he had pretty, pretty deluxe look. If you look, he's got kind of like a sand-colored, cream-colored pants, got a slightly darker jacket with, I don't know, the lining for his pockets and the trim on his lapels is a little the same color as the pants. He's got a kind of a sand-colored, white-colored striped dress shirt underneath, and a really natty orange-gold bow tie, and beautiful watch. I mean, he looks good.
He looks really handsome. Like, he nailed it. If there's a rating from that year, he's got to be 5-star. He looks really sharp.
He looks so desert, too, you know?
He's from Arizona. He played at ASU, still.
Yeah.
So I would totally wear that outfit.
That's probably my favorite. The other great ones, in terms of, I don't know if they're awesome or not, but Karl Malone, it's hard to find footage of this because this was back in the early to mid 80s. So just imagine like poorly fitting, tight, white linen pants where you can definitely see the mailman's package. You've got like a blue mailman dress shirt and you've got a white knit tie that comes to like the bottom of the sternum and has a flat bottom. It's not a pointed, it's just flat. So it's sort of like what Colonel Sanders wears, but not exactly. And then, like, a kind of cheap-looking dark blue sport coat over the top.
It's the pants and the bulge that really, really sell it.
Yeah, it really does. You just know. This guy can rebound, for sure. Rugged.
My probably favorite is Vlade Divac.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Well, he's Eastern European. He looks like he just rolled out of bed or something. I don't know where he was planning to go, but it doesn't look like he was planning to go to the NBA draft.
I think he was supposed to be on the set of Perfect Strangers.
He's Balky's other cousin from Meepos, I believe.
Yeah.
But he's got pleated, wonderful khakis pulled up to the belly button. Just a pencil-thin belt. Just an
The belt is the best touch. I think, Dave, that for me is what makes his outfit so good. It's like one of those really thin braided leather belts, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, judging by the year, you'd have to go with a braided leather belt.
He's got a used car salesman kind of light plaid jacket. Just outstanding.
Unshaven, and the necktie is a little bit loose. It's not tightened all the way up. He's, you know, he wanted to relax a little bit before this picture was taken, and he did.
But he left the top button done. That was the nice touch. Just loosen the tie, but leave the top button on. Hey!
He's now the general manager of the Sacramento Kings. I hope he still wears this outfit to
work. I hope so, too. Yeah, it'd be a big recruiting push from the free agency.
The outfit makes me feel just a little bit sad, too, because I'm like, oh, wait, he's Eastern European. Like, maybe that's the best he could do at that time.
It was state-issued, Dave. He wasn't allowed to buy anything. Okay, Dave, there's two outfits I want you to compare. So both of these make me think of the Jim Carrey movie, The Mask, but for different reasons. The first one is Mike Miller. And everybody knows Mike Miller now as like this guy who can't run up and down the court anymore but still can hit big threes. But look at fresh-faced Mike Miller when he was first drafted into the NBA. And tell me what you see.
Oh, yeah, it feels. I think he's wearing just a cardboard box, it looks like. It's spray painted black with white pinstripes. He's very much a box-shaped man.
And the shoulders are like probably 5 feet wider than his actual shoulders. He's wearing like enormous shoulder pads in that. It looks like a fake. It looks like something from Dick Tracy or The Mask. The other one that's like out of this world good was Samaki Walker. And he was a bust, but he was a player that I loved. He's played for the Mavericks.
This is one of the classic all-time NBA draft fashions. And I don't think you can say he's a bust just because he pays off big with this hat suit combination. No tie. It's all just cream colored, a little bit oversized. And he just tops it off with, what would you even say that hat is?
Kind of a bowler hat. It's sort of like the Monopoly Man hat, I wouldn't, maybe.
the
guy with the monocle.
A little bit more urbanized. It's like an urban 1990s Monopoly hat.
Yeah, I guess it is. It's a bit kind of Monopoly meets cowboy in a way. Really nice. And he wears it so low that it just gives it an extra edge.
Yeah, you want it down about your eyebrows. That's where you want it.
Below, if you can get it there.
Yeah, ideally.
The worst fitting suit maybe of all time was Tim Thomas. Really skinny guy, came out of Villanova. Did you see his picture, Dave? That's how I imagine Manute Bol would have looked in a suit.
It's just the pants. The pants, like, you could fit two or three more Tims in there.
Yeah, they were not cut for him. But, you know.
No.
So, those are some of my favorites. I will say probably the best draft photo ever taken was taken in 1993, and there's two things that make this photo so good. One is that you see every possible tone of industrial couch color in one photo. You want beige, you want brown, you want beige brown, we've got it all. We've got tan. I mean, off yellow, whatever the colors are called, they've got it in that photo. And the second great thing is that both Sean Bradley and George Murison are featured in this photo. And those guys are snazzy dressers.
Could there possibly be another photo, like in the history of the world, where there's two guys that, what are they, 7'5" apiece, something like that? These are gigantic dudes.
Yeah. The only sad part is that they're sitting. But other than that, that's one of the great NBA draft photos ever taken.
And I just enjoyed, I was looking through all the faces, and I recognized a lot of them. And then, boom, right on the end, I think that's Bobby Hurley.
Yeah,
I'm just glad
sure
he got
is.
In there.
Bobby Hurley, right before his car wreck.
But yeah, it's fantastic. We'll put this up on the site just so everybody can enjoy the smiles. I'd say, what, about two-thirds are smiling, and about a third are trying to kind of look tough. And Chris Webber just doesn't seem to know what's going on.
No. He's like, Sean Bradley went number two in this draft? What is going on? So the NBA draft, great time for fashion mavens everywhere. We beat that one into the ground. We want to talk Jurassic World, Jurassic Park, Dave. What do you got for me on this topic?
So the first thing I got for you, and I saw Jurassic World, obviously, and I was pretty excited about it. I was tense with excitement throughout the film, but still, you've seen the original Jurassic Park, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
So let's say shortly after that, if someone wanted you to imagine the coolest possible scenario involving dinosaurs, like what would you say?
The coolest possible thing that could happen would be if they had dinosaur races. Like if you could become a jockey and actually ride velociraptors for races, and that the loser would have to be like eaten or fed. Like it was, you raced for your life, but you got to ride the dinosaurs on their backs.
Excellent answer. But that's actually number two on the list.
Oh, it is? What's number one,
yes.
Dave?
Number one, it's actually very similar, is if you could possibly become the leader of a pack of raptors and ride a motorcycle and lead the raptors on a hunt for another dinosaur. Like, how cool does that sound?
So you're leading the raptor hunt.
You're on a motorcycle riding with the Raptors, and you guys are hunting for this terrible dinosaur that needs to be destroyed.
And the Raptors think of you as one of them.
Not just one of them. You're the alpha.
Leader. Oh, yes. Man. That sounds like a pretty good scenario. How'd they make it happen?
It just naturally happened. I think that they were sitting around a room, a few guys, and they were like, hey, what's the coolest possible thing that could happen with dinosaurs? And after two suggestions, they came up with that one. First, they said the races, like you said. And then second, like, actually, I can top that. Motorcycle leading the hunt. And so they just based the whole film around, we have to make this happen. And he did. He trains the Raptors. They create a new dinosaur. And you've got to find this dinosaur. And there's only one thing to do with it. You get your pack of Raptors. You get on your motorcycle and you go after him.
Wow. So I had thought that this new movie was basically just a Barbasol advertisement, but that's not true?
No, there's way more advertisements also available. You got Margaritaville product placement.
Oh, great.
There's a lot of product placement.
Hey, were there any frozen strudel? Did Alan make an appearance?
Alan, he probably didn't offer enough money. He didn't think that this would reach far enough, but it was a huge mistake. This is film is one of the biggest hits of all time.
Dang it. Was Larry Mullen in it?
No, Larry Mullen. No.
That's why I haven't seen it yet.
You'll get there.
So what would be your overall rating on a scale of 1 to 10?
First of all, you have to understand what you're getting into.
Okay.
You're going to see a movie about dinosaurs, and there's going to be a guy riding a motorcycle with a pack of Raptors in it. So wrap your head around that first, and once you know that, it's 10 out of 10 stars.
If you can't accept
anything that I just laid out, then don't go see it. But if you can accept that, then you have to go see it.
Wow. Who'd you go with, Dave?
I went with my wife. I made her go. She thought it was going to be dumb, and it wasn't. And this is really what I want to bring across. This is the whole reason I brought this up. I want to see if you've ever had an experience like this. But I'm watching the movie. I'm really enjoying it. There's the motorcycle, there's the Raptors, there's everything they're doing is just really tickling my funny bone. I'm loving it. I'm the only person in the theater laughing at the jokes, and I'm laughing at all of them. If there's any joke, I'm 100% in on it. I love it. And I keep turning to Ariane, and I keep poking her, and I keep saying, how could anyone not like this? Who could possibly not enjoy this?
Yeah, Dave, I bet you're the most fun person to watch a movie with of all time. That sounds great. And I also picture you, Dave, are you able to stay still in your seat? Or are you sort of up on your feet a little bit, your feet curled underneath you, sitting on the edge of the seat, ready to leap all the time, standing up, high-fiving people?
It depends on the movie, but for this one, and of course any Fast and Furious movie, I'm pretty tense, leaning forward a little bit. Once Chris Pratt gets on the motorcycle, I'm super tense. I want to jump up and just yell yes.
So Chris Pratt from Parks and Recreation, Andy Dwyer is the protagonist?
And that just makes it all the better if that's what you know him from.
Yeah.
You totally know that Andy Dwyer would be very excited about a guy riding on a motorcycle with dinosaurs.
Well, you just sold me on that movie, Dave.
But have you ever had that experience still where you're
hunting dinosaurs with the pack of lost raptors? Several times. Most recently, and was in 2007, actually. I went to Costa Rica. It was a bachelor party, and just got on my bike, got on my hog, chased down a Diplodocus or whatever, the big Apatosaurus.
Obviously you've done that, so I wasn't referring to that. I'd read some of the criticism of the movie before I went in, and it really colored how I was interacting with the film throughout. And it made me be upset that anyone criticized. Yeah, the whole time I was just like, well, why? Why would anyone? What? This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Have you had the criticism of something that affect how you view it?
Boy, I'm sure I have. I was trying to think of some examples and none came to mind. So I'm doing a great job as a co-host on this segment. Yes, probably.
Yeah, that's a great point. But no, I just thought it was interesting, especially with the kind of internet culture where anyone can be a critic. I mean, we're recording this podcast. we can be critics of popular culture and literature. So many people can give their opinions on things that it's really easy to let that affect how you interact with pop culture.
Mm. I can actually think this is totally probably not what you're looking for, but it's the closest thing I can think of. I hate, generally speaking, academic conferences, and especially the question and answer session after someone's given a talk or a paper. And there's nothing worse. There's two things that are awful. One is when somebody just starts talking about their work and their research, and it's going on for 3, 4, 5 minutes, and it doesn't terminate in a question mark. The point of a Q&A is to ask a question. So if it doesn't terminate in a question mark, that's the pits. And it happens all the time. Someone just wants to talk about their work and just monopolize the room. But the other thing is when someone asks a question about something that was totally irrelevant to what was just presented. And they're like, well, haven't you considered X or Y? And how does that affect your theory? And they're like, no, my theory has nothing to do with X or Y. If it were about X or Y, it would be a different theory. It would be a different book. So people are often criticizing or like, I think the work would be stronger if it paid attention to this thing that it doesn't pay attention to. So I think it's important, like in those situations, like the criticism needs to try to meet the work of art on its terms. Like, what is the work of art or what's the piece of culture attempting to do? And you can't criticize something for not doing something that it didn't intend to do.
I get your point. That's what so much of criticism wants to do, I think, just in general. We find a problem with Jurassic World because it's not artistic or the acting is unbelievable. Or like, I can't believe, why aren't they hiding from this dinosaur? Why are they fighting the dinosaur? And it's the movie, guys. Let's just enjoy it.
It's the movie's reality, yeah.
And I think that's how it is in life a lot, that we want to find some way to criticize something because it's not going to please everybody. But you just need to meet the work, whether it be an academic paper or whether it be the greatest summer movie of all time, Jurassic World. You just need to meet it where it's at.
I agree, Dave. And I think the point that I would make to this is that one of my big pet peeves is hearing people talking about a fictional story or a fictional book saying, oh, that character would never do that. I can't believe that. They're so upset about it. It's a work of fiction. The author or the creator decides precisely what that character would do. The fact that they did it in the work of fiction means that the character would do that thing. And so for the reader to be like, oh, the character would never do that, it just reveals more about the person making that statement and their projection onto that character than it does at all about the work of art. And that's something that I think is endemic, that happens all the time, and it drives me nuts.
And it's funny. I think my wife, Ariane, she goes to see these ridiculous movies with me now, and sometimes we'll even read science fiction books with me and stuff. And she had to make, I guess, the change in her mind from being, oh, this would never happen, this is ridiculous, to just, now she can just meet these works where they're at. She understands, like, we're going to see a dinosaur movie. If he drives a motorcycle with dinosaurs, that's totally cool.
Suspension of disbelief. It's the key thing that you have to accomplish to enjoy that stuff.
And I think this discussion brings us in to the next section of the podcast perfectly.
Perfect.
One of my favorite segments that we ever do, Lost the Plot. So, Steele, a terrific movie. I don't know if you've seen this one, but basically Steele is going to tell us the plot of a film called Escape Plan, starring Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, Escape Plan, starring Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. This one's actually a really it's a slow-moving drama. Most of the critics found it pretty emotionally wrenching. And one of those things that just builds. And this is, it's kind of a sweet story where Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger play an aging couple. They've been together for a long time. They recently were married in a state that permitted same-sex unions. And the film is mostly about retirement planning. And the idea of the escape plan is that they want to get a nest egg that's large enough to let Sylvester Stallone escape, if you will, from his job. He's been a postal worker for 25 years. He knows everybody on the route. But, you know, it just they just want to relax. They want to retire to rural Indiana, settle back down on their grandpa's corn farm, and just make a life, you know. And so the escape plan is basically they decide they're going to start a small business, and they're going to try to start the small business online. And it's really funny because neither of them have that much internet experience. And so it's cute. It's like your grandparents trying to start a business online. And Arnold has some really great lines. Like Sylvester Stallone tells him he needs to pick up the mouse, and he squeaks and runs out of the room screaming because he's scared of mice. He thought he meant an actual mouse. I mean, you know, just stuff like that happens throughout the movie.
Yeah, it's like more heartwarming, like a kind of a comedy sort of thing.
Yeah, and the thing is, in the end, what they realize is the only escape plan they really needed was each other. That was the tagline. It's not about how golden your parachute is, how much money you have socked away in your 401k. The real escape plan is someone to love you. And that's basically the message of the film. And so, I thought, I mean, two thumbs up.
So you both of your thumbs are up for this one.
Yeah, I mean, all my fingers were up for that one. I mean, I was like in tears at the end. I thought, yeah.
So what was it that made it so emotional for you? How did it hit home?
Well, I think it was a lot of things. But really, the thing was they have this kind of slow montage at the end where it's Sylvester Stallone's last day on the postal route, and he realizes that he doesn't even have to look at the names on the mailboxes. He knows everyone on his route by heart. And so as he's delivering the mail, he's not only delivering the mail, he cashed out his 401k, and he dispersed it in 1,000 different shares and gave everyone on his mail route 1/1,000th of his escape plan, retirement plan. And so he made a bunch of people a little bit wealthier, gave away all his wealth. I just thought, way to pay it forward, Sly.
That's beautiful. The way you're describing it, it just makes me feel like one of them might have gotten cancer at some point during the movie. Did that happen or no?
You know, I don't remember that part. There was a scene that was set in a hospital. There was a close call, but I can't remember if it was – I think – is Hodgkin's lymphoma, is that a kind of cancer?
Yes, it is.
Okay, then it was cancer. Yeah, Hodgkin's lymphoma.
That's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, I'd really like to see that, embrace them.
Yeah. I was going to say one of the real sweet moments actually was a pun on the disease name because, you know, he's kind of ailing. He's in bed and he says, come over here and give me a Hodge kiss. And they're like, oh, and then he did.
I'm really wanting Arnold to say it's not a tumor at some point in that film.
Yeah, he did say that.
Oh, thank goodness.
Apparently it was very meta. It was a reference to another film, I guess.
Yeah, people love that. Well, Steele, that's heartwarming, and that is actually very close to the plot of the real escape plan.
Sweet.
Except I'm going to lay it out for you real quick because it's fantastic.
Okay.
Sylvester Stallone just happens to be an expert at escaping prisons.
Oh, prisons.
No, this isn't actually a retirement dramedy. This is straight up action.
Okay.
Surprisingly.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you know, he gets paid six figures a year. They'll plant him in different prisons, and he'll show the weaknesses of these prisons, and he'll break out, and then they'll be able to increase their security. I mean, it's actually a very, very timely picture now that recently there was a major escape in the news of those two convicted killers.
Yeah.
I think Sylvester Stallone saw that this could be a problem in the future, so he wanted to address it.
It reminds me of Joe Bluth from Arrested Development.
Yeah?
Yeah. Remember he gets locked into prison so that he can prove that he's a master magician and escape.
Well, Stallone does like it. That. He does it more through toughness than finesse.
Yeah.
And a lot of intelligence, just, you know, making like a screwdriver out of weird stuff, unscrewing screws in the solitary confinement cells, and getting out. Just like really good stuff. So what happens, of course, though, is someone takes advantage of this. They want to quiet Sylvester Stallone, so they send him to the most secure facility in all the world. It's been built based on a book that he's written, his specifications.
Whoa.
He's sent in there and he tries to give him the code word because he's not going to be able to get out. He doesn't like this situation. He gives the warden the code word that would just let him leave, and the warden's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
So he's been set up.
He's set up. He's locked in for real. Just take one guess. Who's the toughest guy in the prison?
Would it be Arnold Schwarzenegger?
It's Arnold Schwarzenegger!
And hold on, Dave. Before we get to this part, why does Sylvester want to get out? I mean, is there just freedom, or does he have something on the outside? Does he have anybody? Is there any part of his life that we see that's not breaking out of prison?
There is a woman at work that you feel like there could be a romantic connection with if he would just stop getting put in prisons. That he would have long enough to really make this spark grow into a fire.
So no, not really. I mean, but there's somebody he has talked to a couple of times that happens to be a woman. But basically, it's the prison. Okay, cool. I didn't want to get distracted from the main focus there.
But immediately, Arnold Schwarzenegger becomes Stallone's best friend. And I'm going to throw out a spoiler alert here, guys. I think I'm going to spoil the movie. And the whole time you're like, you're wondering, why is Schwarzenegger suddenly best friends with Stallone? Like, he just met him just one moment ago. But Schwarzenegger's like buddies. And they're all of a sudden, they're hatching plans. They're getting in fake fights. And they're trying to figure out how to escape together.
Wow. So the spoiler was that they become friends, or the spoiler is that they escape?
They do escape.
Okay.
Still.
Shock.
The plan comes to full fruition. There's some secret identities revealed. Schwarzenegger the whole time wasn't actually who he was saying he was, but he was someone else, believe it or not. And it was Schwarzenegger's daughter in the film that actually set Stallone up, because he wanted Stallone to spring Schwarzenegger. So that's how suddenly Schwarzenegger's best friends with Stallone, because he knows this guy is here.
His ticket.
To do my escape plan.
Nice.
They fight. A lot of people get shot. Another guy they're escaping with, they just leave him with a gun. He gets shot up and dies, but he gives him just enough time to get out. And it, really, the most surprising thing of the whole film is that it was actually an okay movie. Like, I was watching it, and I was like, hey, this wasn't bad. That was the biggest shock.
What'd the triplets think of it?
They were actually in bed, still, believe it or not.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been safe for them to watch my version of Escape Plan, but apparently yours is a bit more violent.
I think, really, they should have produced both versions and released them at the same time, a little experimentation, see what happens.
Yeah, I don't know why more Hollywood executives aren't listening to our Lost the Plot segments and just picking up on my pitches, because they're good.
Yeah, they should be like, wait a second, yeah, that's great, let's call up Arnold.
Yeah, well, so that's Lost the Plot. Thanks, everyone. That was Escape Plan. Classic Hollywood cinema. We want to talk a little bit about names. As if you've listened to this show, you probably know that I love names. I don't know why it is, Dave, but nothing thrills me quite as much as considering a bunch of awesome names. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you want us to consider today? What are we going to go into?
I was reading this recently, and this was really distressing to me, Dave. Since 1900, there's been some fluctuation in the proportion of names that come from the Bible that are given to babies. It was around, 17.5% at the start of the century. It rose to a high of about 21% during the mid-80s. But since that time, it has been in precipitous decline. And it is now just over 13% of all babies have biblical names.
This is a crisis.
It is a crisis. And we need to do something about this. Now, we know that the most popular boy's name in 2014 was a biblical name. It was Noah.
Thank you.
For girls, there were only two of the top 10 that came from the Bible, and they were sort of fake. I mean, Sophia, which is kind of, it's the name of wisdom, and then Abigail. But I don't think people think of the Bible so much when they give those names.
No.
If you look over the last 100 years, though, 6 of the top 10 boys' names have been Bible names, 17 of the top 50, and for girls, 3 of the top 10, and 9 of the top 50. It's harder for girls because the Bible is a patriarchal document with not a lot of women in it, so it's a bit harder. But what I wanted to say is that we need to do something about this. We need more biblically themed names, and we don't need just the Peters and the Pauls and the Mark and the Ezekiels. We need to reclaim some of the forgotten Bible names.
Yeah, there's more depth there. There's a lot of characters in the Bible that people are forgetting about. There's a huge store of knowledge that we can open up.
Dave, if you had to pick like an underrated Bible name just off the top that people should be considering for their next born child, what would you go with?
I like the name Ephraim.
Ephraim.
I give him Ephraim. You call him Eph. He's just going to be a terrific young musician.
Ephraim is a good name, yeah. Yeah, there's a city. There's Ephraim in Wisconsin. It's up in Door County, so it's a beautiful vacation spot.
Oh, yeah. Is that near the Dells?
It's not very close, but it's in the same state, yeah.
Okay, that sounds nice. Two for one.
Exactly, come to Wisconsin. I will say probably the best father in the Bible was an underrated character. His name was Aram, A-R-A-M, and he had four sons. And when you hear his sons' names, you'll realize why he was the greatest father of the Bible. His first son was named Uz, U-Z. Mm-hmm. His second son was Hul, H-U-L. Third son, Gether,
nice.
G-E-T-H-E-R. And fourth was Mash. His fourth son was named Mash. So if you have quadruplets, if you got four boys, and you're thinking about retroactively changing their names, who's Hul, Gether, and Mash? It's a great little combo.
It flows off the tongue. That it must have been a powerful family.
Yeah. I love the name Habakkuk. I think that one's underrated. Of all the biblical books or the prophets, Habakkuk is a real good one.
Mm-hmm.
Habby.
And anytime I hear the name Enos for a second, yeah. I'm like, hey, that's a terrific name. And then I think about it for a little bit longer, and I'm like, no, I cannot ever use that name.
It could be a great middle name if their first name started with the letter P, and they just... But anyway, I think of Enos, and there was an old baseball player named Enos Slaughter, played for the St. Louis Cardinals. He once scored from first in a World Series off a single, and I think that is probably one of the greatest human names ever achieved, Enos Slaughter.
And it's biblical. You're making your point just over and over again.
That was the Abrahamic covenant. In fact, it was a penis slaughter. Wait, I shouldn't say that. I love the names that end with E and Er. So there's Benoni, Naphtali, and then the great Ers are Abner and Gomer. Not enough Gomers out there.
And I genuinely like the name Asher. You can throw that in there.
Yeah, my name is Asher Lev. That's a really good name. It's already taken.
Fantastic. It's a terrific book.
But I have to say, if you're going to go with a name, you really want to go with a name that features a Z, the letter Z. There's so many good Bible Z names, and they're underrepresented. They were looking at like biblical names distribution, and the names that end with L do well, but the names that have Z's don't do so well.
No, no one wants to use a Z, just in general. If you think of a Z name, the only name I can think of is Zach. I've got nothing else.
What about Nebuchadnezzar? Huh?
Powerful, yeah.
Zebedee, Zebulon. You got Maharshalal Hashbaz, which is just rolls off the tongue. It's a sentence. Isaiah had a kid with a harlot, and that was the kid's name. There's Azrael, who was the angel of death. If you're like a metal family, then that's a good one. I'm surprised Felix isn't named Azrael.
How is there not a wrestler named Azrael? How does that not happen?
That'd be so good. And there's Amaziah or Amazia. I don't know how you'd pronounce it, but Amazia would be a good kind of variant on that one.
I think it just depends on where you're from. Amaziah? But I like Amazia. That's terrific.
And you know, I grew up with a friend named Nate, and everybody knew his name was Nathan. And Nathan has been used before, but there's a couple biblical variants if you want to use them. There's Dathan, which is like Nathan, but if you have a cold. Hi, my name is Dathan. And then there's El Nathan, which is really popular in like Spanish-speaking countries.
Yeah, you're really claiming the name Nathan if you throw an Nathan. L in front of it.
Yeah,
I'm El Nathan, dude. Come on.
So those are some of my favorites. But if you want to go like multisyllabic, there's three that are really the cream of the crop. Multisyllabic names, there's the king of Assyria, Tilgath-Pilneser.
Excellent.
There's Berodach-Baladan, who was a king of Babylon.
Whoa, that sounds pretty badass, really. That could definitely be the name of like a Stallone character or Schwarzenegger. Berodach-Baladan.
I'm Berodach-Baladan. That's. I think that was actually Dan Jenningen's birth name, unsurprisingly. He just goes by Dan for short. And then Joseph, you know, the multicolored dream coat, when he went to Egypt, his name was Zaphnath-Paaneah.
Yeah, what do you think they called him for short down there?
Zaphnath?
Yeah, I guess you'd have to. Or hey, Zaphnath, come lie with me.
Yeah, come lie with me, Zaphnath-Paaneah. But Zaphnath on its own is pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, tempting. There aren't a lot of, I don't think, quite as good choices for women, but I will say there's three that really stand out.
I'd love to hear them.
First, Abishag.
I don't know that that's usable in this day and age, post-Austin Powers.
Yeah, well, Abigail, Abishag. Abishag's a bit more promiscuous, socially adventurous.
She's going to have a more interesting life, that's for sure.
Dorcas. Dorcas is a classic. There was a fantastic track athlete here at the UW-Madison that I interviewed once. Her name was Dorcas.
Did she go by Dorcas? What did she do?
She went by Dorcas.
She just owned it, huh?
Yeah, she's like, you can call me Dork for short, but everybody went with Dorcas. We call our baby Dorcas sometimes. So the last of the great Bible names for women, though, is actually Base Math.
Are you sure that's not like a demon from a fantasy book?
Yeah, it's definitely one of the enemies you fight in Final Fantasy II. You rolled 7. You must face Base Math. No, it's probably Basemoth, but I like Base Math a little better.
I think it has a nice tone to it.
Yeah.
It's funny, we have a picture book version of the Bible at my house. And anytime the girls see a picture of a woman in it, they just point and they say, Mary. Yeah. And they're pretty much right.
Yeah. Someone needs to get some illustrations of Base Math in those kids' illustrated Bibles. They spice it up for the women.
It doesn't sound like it'd be terrifying. I don't know what she's doing.
So those are my tips, pro tips. Go out there, reproduce, and name your kids after obscure Bible characters. We need to get that percentage rate back up to 1980s levels.
Now, and it seems like you're leaning on Old Testament than New Testament.
Old Testament, hey, sure.
Why? Why do you want old?
You know. Okay, if you want a New Testament name, you could go with Linus. But, I mean, again, I think New Testament, there's some Hebrew names, but a lot of it's the Greek influence. And the Greeks just, the Semitic, those Hebrew names are just so much better.
And New Testament names are mostly just played out. Yeah. Like we've all met enough Peters. We've seen them.
Paul's.
Matthew.
Timothy's.
Yeah, get a new name, guys. Come on.
Bartholomew, even.
Your name didn't come from the Bible, but David, that's clearly biblical. It's served me pretty well so far.
You know, it was a really unpopular name among the Puritans who settled the Americas, the Pilgrims.
He made some mistakes in the Bible. David didn't always make the right choice.
But hey, it's still a super popular name among Jews. So you're doing all right, Dave. People of the book.
And you know that I love the Jewish people.
Yeah. It's hard not to.
Seriously. You just look at the culture, the authors, the music coming from Jewish people. I'm a huge fan.
But speaking of loving Jewish people, Dave, you've got an induction to the Off the Chain Hall of Fame this week, don't you?
So I got really excited this week, Steele, because we bought some gummy worms at the store. And gummy worms have been a huge hit around my house. Everybody's talking about them. We can't get enough of this bag of gummy worms. Every time we finish a meal, someone is saying, I ate everything. Do I get to have a gummy worm now?
Yeah.
And it's a great feeling to be able to say, yes, we have a bag of gummy worms. Let's have one.
That is a great feeling. And are worms your favorite gummy shape?
I like the classics. You know me. I love candy. I was just talking to my wife earlier today about why I have so many cavities right now. And she said it's got to be that your teeth are constantly coated in sugar. And maybe she's right. Since I was a kid, I just love candy. Just pure sugar. I like chocolate. That's fine. But I'm talking about just the weird sugar creations from sugar.
Sugar's good.
Do you have a top candy or like any childhood
Sour Patch Kids,
candy?
Dave, Sour Patch Kids. It used to be Jolly Ranchers for me. I would just get a whole huge bag of Jolly Rancher, and I'd mix like two at a time, so double flavors, put one on one side of the mouth, the other on the other, and then put them together sometime. I mean, like the old, when you, they used to do lemon ones, the cherry lemon.
Ooh,
turn your eyeballs inside out. So I like that intense sugar and sour flavor. So Sour Patch Kids are probably my go-to sugar candy now.
Yeah, they're terrific. They give you that sour flavor, but they pay off with sweetness. They're not just going sour all the way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many interesting candies. And I think the forefather of a lot of this stuff, the forefather of Runtz, the forefather of Sour Patch Kids, to where we could really start experimenting and making really interesting candy, is the gummy bear.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about the origin of the gummy bear?
I'm guessing it comes from Central Europe because they love bears there.
They're huge bear fans. It was invented by a man named Hans Riegel back in the 1920s.
Uh-oh.
He just got some gelatin, got some sugar, got some molds, and he made gummy bears. They're delicious. So Hans is just this fine young German man that's experimenting with sugar and gelatin, and he comes up with a fantastic idea. I feel like it was just like a great leap forward. Like Einstein helped leap physics forward, or these other great innovators, Henry Ford and the production of the automobile. Hans Riegel is the person that was able to take candy from just like, hey, here's some peppermint sticks. Everybody who wants a peppermint stick? Anybody? Yeah. Nobody wanted one. So he made gummy bears. Suddenly, we start getting all sorts of different kind of candies. He's the first one to really take sugar and start to see it fulfill its promise as a condiment, as an ingredient.
And, I mean, I have to credit him for making horse hooves delicious as well. I mean, up until then, everybody's just like, oh, great, got a barrel full of horse hooves. Those aren't selling either. So infusing it with sugar was a really great move for the glue rendering plants.
Isn't that, it's like, I think I've been told before that you make gelatin from dead animal parts.
I definitely do, yeah. Who told you about my secret? Oh, you didn't mean you as in me, you meant just in general.
And no, I thought that that's what, something you did like on the weekends. That was one of your things.
It's my hobby, artisan gelatin.
But gelatin, it's made from animal parts. I didn't know. If you're a vegan, you got to avoid your Jellos and your gummies. You can't do it.
Do you have a preferred brand, Dave, for your gummies?
The brand we've been talking about that Hans Riegel founded and then was later pushed forward by his Nazi sons is Haribo.
That all comes together. So you want to induct some Nazis into the Off the Chain Hall of Fame is what you're saying, Dave?
No, Steele, I appreciate what Hans did for us, but it's really the symbol.
And so the swastika. It's the swastika you wanted. I get it, yeah. Well, this is devolving rapidly.
It's the symbol of progress that the gummy bear gives us, Steele.
The gummy bear is
a unifying thing. You bring a gummy bear to anyone, any creed, any sect, any race, they're going to enjoy this gummy bear. I don't know about Hans Riegel. I know his son served in the German military in World War II. They were released from Allied prison camps and went home to further Haribo and possibly use slave labor to do so. I don't know. There's some allegations out there. So I don't want to induct those guys to the Hall of Fame.
Good call.
I appreciate what they've done, but they don't quite make OTC Hall of Fame. What does is the gummy bear,
yeah,
and the great leap forward in candy that it represents to me.
That's a great choice. When it comes to gummy candy, you really dodged a bullet. I'm so glad you did not induct peach rings. Peach rings are awful, and they make farts smell terrible. Don't induct those.
No, but I enjoy all gummy candies. I'll be honest. Peach rings, I'll eat them. Apple rings, terrific. I love the little cola bottles. Yeah. Huge fan.
I like, what are the, they're like Twizzlers, but they're coated with sugar and they're kind of sticky.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? I like those a lot.
It's all gummy. It's all delicious. It all has horse hooves and sugar in it. And I love it. I'm grateful for the gummy bear because the gummy bear showed us that we can take gummy sweets and make them into anything we want. We don't have to be limited.
Can I tell you my favorite gummy bear story, Dave?
I'd love to hear it.
My best friend Jack Bangeter, I loved gummy bears in high school. And so his mom, I think, had gone to Costco or something. We had like a huge, she had filled up one of those big glass containers with gummy bears. And we were playing Heroes of Might and Magic, turn-based role-playing game on the computer. And just eating gummy bears, eating a ton of them. And then we leave the lid off and we go off and do something else. We come back and we're playing again. And we're like, man, a lot of those gummy bears are missing. We really ate a bunch of those, and we just kept eating it. And then, like, an hour later, we hear Jack's dog going, and we look over, and he had just vomited, like, a pile of probably 200 to 300 gummy bears that he must have ingested out of the big glass thing. And they had spent some time in his stomach, so they got all fused together, and some of the gummy bear features had been melted, and it was just like an enormous gelatinous mass of partially digested gummy bears. But it goes to show you, gummy bears are delicious. Even dogs will eat them past the point of health.
They can't digest them, but they still want them. They're wonderful.
So yeah, that's my gummy bear story.
And that's our this week's induction into the OTC Hall of Fame. It's been a while since we threw something in there, but gummy bears.
Congratulations,
thank you, gummy bears,
to the gummy
for
bear.
What you've done for me.
Beautiful, Dave. Well, we're coming to that part of the show when we wrap things up a little bit. This weekend is the 4th of July. And the 4th of July means America celebrates its independence. And we wanted to share some music, some tunes that put people in the mood, both celebrating some of the amazing accomplishments, some of the great things about America, and some of the dark side of America. So we're going to play some pro and some less pro American songs for the 4th. You want to start us off, Dave? What do we want to hear first?
Well, Stillman, nothing is more pro-America than John Wayne. The only thing more pro-America than John Wayne is a John Wayne spoken word album about how America is great. And still, I first heard this album because for some reason my wife owns it on record. It's called America, Why I Love Her by John Wayne. And it's just him talking about America for a good 12 tracks. The opening track is, of course, Why I Love Her.
You ask me why I love her? Well, give me time. I'll explain. You've seen a Kansas sunset or an Arizona rain? Have you drifted on a bayou down Louisiana way? Have you watched the cold fog drifting over San Francisco Bay? Have you heard a Bob White calling in the Carolina pines? Or heard the bellow of a diesel at the Appalachia mines? Does the call of the Niagara thrill you when you hear her waters roar? You look with awe and wonder at her Massachusetts shore, where men who braved a hard new world first stepped on Plymouth Rock.
Wow. You've done half of those things, Dave. You're living. You're living right.
Yeah, when you can shake your head yes to most of those things, it's very exciting.
Talk about patriotism, Dave. You inspired me there with John Wayne. I want to play a song that's probably the most pro-America, the most stirring song that I can think of, and one of the most beautiful versions by a legend, you know, the great Ray Charles. I think the first time I heard this song was probably in the Sandlot. It is Ray Charles singing America the Beautiful, and this is everything that's great about this country.
For heroes proved in liberating strife, who more than self? country loved. And mercy more than life. America. America.
Well, those are two fantastic, very pro-America songs. I think one of my personal favorite songs having to do with America, of course, has to do with Immigrants Coming to America, written by the great Neil Diamond.
Far, we've been traveling far, without a home, not without a star.
Yeah, Dave, there's only been one artist in all of my life that I've owned multiple t-shirts of, and it's Neil Diamond.
Oh my goodness, he's fantastic. One, my parents still go to concerts occasionally, and what they'll do during like the encore or during like one of the coolest songs is they'll call, and you'll just hear in the background whoever's playing. And they did this for me when they saw Neil, and it was Brother Love's Travel and Salvation Show.
Such a good song.
I love Neil. Yeah, we probably have more Neil Diamond records than anybody else.
That's a good way to live. When I was, for my 21st birthday, Dave, I bought myself a Neil Diamond concert t-shirt at a thrift store in England. It made an otherwise rough two-year stretch a little bit brighter.
He just brings brightness. It's just what he does. Great voice. Another Jewish artist bringing us joy.
Yeah, thank you, America. Well, Dave, I don't know, the last super positive American song that I want to play, I think I've got to go with John Cougar Mellencamp. And there's two obvious choices here, Dave, and I don't know which one to go with. It's basically a coin flip. You want to just put one on and then we'll just see how it goes from there?
I love everything this guy does.
There's a black man with black hair, little black man. He's got an interstate running through his front yard. You know, he thinks he's got it so good. And there's a woman in the kitchen cleaning up the evening slime. And he looks at her and says, hey, darling, I can remember when you could stop a cloud. Oh, but ain't that America for you and me? Ain't that America something to see, baby? Ain't that America almost free? Yeah, little pink houses for you and me.
I think if you want to have a hit rock song, you just add a guitar, some drums, and some extremely pro-American lyrics, and you're there. Hey, I'm in.
Well, Dave, as you know, things aren't always rosy in America. The United States has some flaws, and there's been some songs that may have noticed and pointed out a couple of those flaws, or just paint a more complex picture to help us have a fuller understanding of what the Fourth of July is really about.
Wait a second. Are these foreign artists? Are these Canadians? I don't understand.
The Guess Who is what I was thinking of, yeah. Anything from your list, Dave, that you think would qualify as a ambivalent American song that you want to play for us?
I think Bruce Springsteen's entire catalog both celebrates America and helps us see that there are some flaws in our country. Mm-hmm. But Bruce, he just wants everything to get better. So that's why he writes and sings songs like this one.
Hey, I didn't catch where he was born, Dave. Where was he born?
I believe that's our country, USA. Oh,
sweet.
And what's funny, what's great about this song is even you put this in the pro-America song cue to begin with, and people always just like, they only hear the chorus. It's born in the, like, yeah, born in the USA. But the verses are actually like really, you know, talking about some dark things.
It's basically about a guy getting sent off to go kill in war, right? And how it ruins him and destroys him. And...
yeah, he gets sent to Vietnam and because he was born in the USA. That's why he got sent there.
Dang it. Well, there's a song that's sure to infuriate lots of people. This is actually a musician that my wife and I really like. His name is Brother Ali. He's a white rapper born in Madison, Wisconsin, based out of Minneapolis. And he suffers from albinism. He's an albino, which led to lots of mocking and persecution growing up. But he's recorded some great songs. And this is a song that's a tribute to Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn. And the song's called Uncle Sam Goddamn. And it is very catchy.
Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. Grand Imperial Guard, where the dollar is sacred and proud. Let's do the shift real, come on now. Smoke and mirrors, stripes and stars, stoning for the cross in the name of God. Bloodshed, genocide, rape and fraud, written to the pages of the law, good law. The cold continent latchkey child ran away one day and started acting foul. King of where the wild things are, daddy's proud, cause the Roman Empire done passed it down. Imported and tortured the workforce and never healed the wounds or shook the curse off. Now the grown-up Goliath nation holding open auditions for the part of David. Can you feel? Nothing can save you. You question the reign, you get rushed in and chained up. Fist raised, but I must be insane, cause I can't figure a single goddamn way to change. Welcome to the United Snakes, land of the thief, home of the slave. The Grand Imperial.
Hey Dave, happy 4th of July.
Hey Steele, that guy, he can just move to Canada, okay? No, I understand, our country's not perfect, but on the 4th of July, that's the one day of the year that we like to at least pretend that it is, and I love it here. So let's go out with a great American man, just playing a great American song from a great American movie.
Just hide behind the wheel.
America, Dave. That's a complex song, too. James Brown, what an interesting guy he was.
Yeah, he probably wouldn't have only positive things to say about America, but today I do. 4th of July, I love my country. It's fantastic. I'll stay here.
Thanks, Dave. I really have appreciated living in America as well. United States, it's my home. Well, Dave, I want to close this out with some book wisdom. For all that we've said in praise of America, this is, again, focusing on the darker side, as I want to do. This is from a passage from a really remarkable speech by the former slave and abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass. In 1852, he was invited to give a speech to the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society in Rochester, New York, on July 5th. And he gives a speech called The Meaning of the Fourth of July 4th for the Negro. And this is a passage from that speech. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondman making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. What, to the American slave, is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and equality hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. He goes on, and the end, near the end, he does present a message of hope, Dave, by saying, allow me to say in conclusion, notwithstanding the dark picture I have this day presented of the state of the nation, I do not despair of this country. There are forces in operation which must inevitably work the downfall of slavery. The arm of the Lord is not shortened, and the doom of slavery is certain. I, therefore, leave off where I began, with hope. Walled cities and empires have become unfashionable. The arm of commerce has borne away the gates of the strong city. Intelligence is penetrating the darkest corners of the globe. It makes its pathway over and under the sea as well as on the earth. Wind, steam, and lightning are its chartered agents. Oceans no longer divide, but link nations together. From Boston to London is now a holiday excursion. Space is comparatively annihilated. Thoughts expressed on one side of the Atlantic are distinctly heard on the other.
This is from over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
But I like the message. I would want the 4th of July to be a time of hope for everybody, that it's not just celebrating freedom or what we have, but celebrating a hope that things can continue to improve and continue to get better.
Right. For me, I love this because it's a reminder for me not to forget in the celebration of liberty and freedom the people that we do oppress or the suffering in our society, and to remember that the things that we celebrate and rejoice in are not even now universally shared or universally enjoyed, and to make that like a goal or a mission to say who is marginalized and who's on the fringes of our society, what can we do to bring them in to give them something to celebrate the next 4th of July?
Well, let's go celebrate. Let's watch some fireworks and just believe in freedom still.
Did I tell you my Poison story? We should have played Poison's cover of, didn't they do it? I went to see Kiss with Poison when I was living in Washington, D.C. I got free tickets from one of the Senator Bill Bennett's office, had free tickets. This is like 2004, so it's like the early days of the Iraq War. He gets up there and he goes, "All right, everybody, I want to dedicate this song to everybody who's out there kicking ass for freedom." And then he played something to Believe In, and like the place went nuts. It was redneck heaven. It was amazing.
You got to know your audience still, and he knows.
Dedicate your song to everybody who's kicking ass for freedom. Meaning
that's right. That's what I dedicate this podcast to today, is everybody who's out there kicking ass for freedom.
Well, that's a wrap.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
This is sincere, Steele. I never actually usually listen to the show. It's just too tedious and boring. But with me off the show, I found it quite enjoyable. My girls thought it was super amazing. We just went through the catalog, and the girls are like, "Watch this video."
Listen, honey, you have to trust me. I'm going to take us to church. You just sit on the back. This is terrible. We're going to cut this off.
We've recorded for almost 2 hours. If we get an hour out of this, it'll be terrific.